If I look happy this morning, it's because the San Francisco Giants won last night, and I'm originally from San Francisco. But they've been known for a long time to torture the fans of San Francisco and also to be called the heart attack kids. And working in Sorghum, I kind of feel the same way. We don't get a lot of respect. Giants didn't get a lot of respect for a long time. We never got a lot of funding. Giants never got a lot of funding. But I believe we do hit home runs every once in a while. So much for my baseball. In order to understand, I think, Sorghum a little bit, and the tremendous amount of variation and variability that's within Sorghum, you have to understand a little bit about its domestication. This is just a graphic outlining four of the five major races in Sorghum. But more importantly, I think, what this is showing to you is how this diversity in Sorghum really originated. You have the bicolors that kind of oversit all these here. I guess you can't point that. You have the bicolors that sit all of this. But you have various races that developed, the Duras and Caudatums in Sudan and Ethiopia, from actually sea level all the way up to 2,000 meters. You have the Guineas that originated in very high rainfall areas, very open panicles, drooping panicles to allow water to basically run off the panicle. You have the Kaffirs, which were more of a tight, almost a millet-like thing down in South Africa. And then you had the spread of the Duras into India, and then germplasm into China. And this all brought about a tremendous amount of variability and variation that we now have in the Sorghum collection, I think is unique among almost all of the crops that we grow around the world. We've just had these pockets of isolations in various areas around the world, in various different climates, at different altitudes, that have really allowed us to develop a just tremendous broad-based source of germplasm. And consequently, you have a picture like this around the world. The reason I show this is because just to kind of show that we in the United States have been really able to exploit that diversity, you'll notice these are the top 10 sorghum-producing countries around the world, according to the FAO. We don't have very many acres in the United States, and yet we are one of the top producing countries in the world, primarily because of our ability to exploit the germplasm that we've been able to utilize over the years. Nigeria, India, both plant a lot more sorghum than we do. Their yields have been fairly stagnant over the last long time, many, many, many years. But we have actually made tremendous progress in the United States, primarily because of our ability to exploit that tremendous genetic diversity that we've been able to utilize. I show you this because really, as you go back and look at sorghum and sorghum's improvement, there's really three major things that happen in sorghum that helped really push our ability to utilize germplasm. This top graph is our sorghum acres, and I can talk ad nauseum into this, why we continue to see declines in sorghum acres. This has very little to do with our ability to increase yields. These are political issues, competitiveness issues, really us being pushed out of traditional sorghum acres by corn and soybeans, farm bill programs. I mean, there's a whole bunch of other things driving this decline, but we've actually continued to make some progress in our yield over the years. And I'm going to get back to that in a little bit later. But we really had three things that really, I think, allowed us to really begin to use sorghum germplasm efficiently. The first was the sorghum conversion program. The second was a little thing called green bugs. And finally, the start of Insermill. And I'm going to highlight one other thing that's just come about fairly recently, and that's, I think, will take us to the next step in terms of our ability to exploit our germplasm sources even greater. This is what the sorghum conversion program looked like. It was a very long and tedious process. people identified germplasm sources. If you don't know much about sorghum, sorghum is a tropical crop. It is photoperiod sensitive. About 90%, 85 to 90% of the germplasm is photoperiod sensitive. You can't grow it here in the U.S. And so really back in the early 60s, some very forward-thinking people, J.C. Stevens, Daryl Rosenau, Fred Miller, really began to understand that in order for us to continue to make progress on sorghum, we needed to start converting some of that tropical material into temperate-like material so we could actually look at it here in the United States. So basically what we were trying to do is take that tropically adapted material that would not flower in the U.S. and through several back-crossing processes and selections, convert that to a dwarf combine height sorghum that would flower in the United States that we could evaluate in the United States. But not only in the United States, but worldwide. One of the things that did happen with the conversion program is as material was converted, it was put into various programs worldwide to evaluate for various disease and insect pressures. So essentially what we did was convert this thing, tall, 14, 15 foot tall, not flowering, and actually this is the converted line. So it was a tremendous program that took a lot of time and effort to actually move material from here to here that we could then efficiently use in the United States. We've converted over 700 lines, and it's been a tremendous source of downy mildew, head smut, anthracnose, green bugs, chinch bugs, midge, drought tolerance. I mean, you can name a lot of the improvements in sorghum and really reflect them back to our use in the conversion program. For whatever reason, the ARS decided not to continue with their part of the conversion program, and so the conversion program kind of sat in limbo for several years, and when the United Sorghum Checkoff Program started, we actually partnered with MMR Genetics and a couple people within the ARS to restart the conversion program. And through gene technologies, we are using markers on the maturity genes and some of the height genes. We are trying to more rapidly convert exotic lines. Hopefully, the first set of released material will come out here within the next year or two. And instead of a 5 to 8 year process, which the old conversion program typically ran, we hope to have things converted within a 2 to 3 year time frame. So we kind of restarted this program, and because we believe that in order for us to continue to make progress, we're going to have this material in our collections, in our arsenal to make improvements. Just some things that we've gotten out of these programs. Yellow endosperm was introduced in 1951. We really didn't make a lot of headway with that until we got more converted lines. We got some nutritional benefits from this, tropical rot resistance, larger seeds, stiff stalk. So we always seem to have corn envy. And, you know, one of the complaints with early sorghum was it was white and endosperm was white. And obviously it didn't have the nutritional quality of corn. So one of the first things our breeders did was work on getting yellow endosperm into corn, so into sorghum so it could look more like corn. And so most of our commercial hybrids now have yellow endosperm, really driven by the fact that people complain that we didn't have yellow endosperm. Stay green characteristic, that came out of a converted line, a partially converted line that Daryl Rosenau recognized. And essentially, we went from some inbred lines that would just not tolerate any kind of post-flowering drought at all to things that stayed green. And this has been a tremendous source of our drought tolerance in our commercial hybrids. Some more recent introductions that have come through the conversion program are zero-zeros. These are tan plants with white food grade sorghums in that. Very high yield potential, widely adapted. In fact, we have just gotten an agreement with ADM, and ADM is producing a sorghum flour now for commercial use. So we're actually moving into a food industry, which is something that we in the industry have been fighting for a long time, but really have never been able to kind of break that barrier. So we're actually, because of our germplasm sources, have been able to get into an area that we traditionally would not think of as a sorghum area. The other thing that happened was the green bug. This little thing came about. We were making tremendous progress with our hybrids. The sorghum industry converted to hybrids in 1957. And in 57, 100% of our sorghum acres were planted to cultivars. We averaged about 20 bushels an acre. We converted in 3 years. By 1960, 100% of the sorghum acres in the country were being grown to hybrids, and we had doubled our yields in 3 years. So hybrid and hybrid vigor was a tremendous improvement for sorghum producers. But along the way, we kind of had a fairly narrow germ base, and this little thing called green bug, you know, and that's magnified several times. They don't look like that in the field. They're a little bit smaller than that. But this thing came in and really devastated the sorghum industry, and we lost about $100 million in 1968 to this little thing. And we spent several years back-crossing resistance, which we found in some very unique sorghum germplasm, a combine kaffir, a tunis grass hybrid that somebody had stumbled onto. But if you remember back to that yield slide, we were kind of stagnant in those years. That was back-crossing this resistance into commercial lines to get green bug resistance. And we really kind of stagnated with our yield growth there. But again, because of the fact that we did have this in our genetic arsenal, we were able to rapidly, within about 3 years, have commercial hybrids that had green bug resistance in it, which had a huge impact. Now you almost can't sell a hybrid without green bug resistance in it. The other thing that had a tremendous impact for us was a thing called Insermill. This was the International Sorghum and Millet Program. It was started in 1979. And this really allowed us to see sorghum germplasm. Prior to that, we were pretty much stuck with a few introductions that had come into the United States. People were experimenting a little bit with the Rockefeller collection. But remember, in the United States, if you grew that material out, that material was essentially photoperiod sensitive, and we really couldn't evaluate it very well. What Insermill allowed sorghum researchers to do was really get outside the United States. And that had a tremendous impact in our ability to actually go out and look at sorghum germplasm worldwide. So we had people in the areas where caudatums were domesticated, actually looking how caudatums responded in their particular environments. And with that knowledge, being able to bring back germplasm sources that had unique characteristics that we could try and start working with here in the U.S. Same thing with the caudatums, same thing with the cappers. This really gave us the ability to see what these things really looked like in their natural environment, and then if there were things that we could try and fully exploit in our germplasm collections. And I believe this really allowed in the sorghum community an unparalleled germplasm exchange and evaluation to happen. Prior to 1979, we did not know very much about sorghum in Africa, aside from the few trips that a couple of our research people made. After Insermill got started, we started developing international yield trials. We developed international disease nurseries, international food grade nurseries, international insect nurseries. We sent sorghum all over the world for evaluation in different countries, and everybody was able to worldwide look at this germplasm and evaluate this germplasm. So from this really wild collection of material, I mean, we have a tremendous amount of variability that we could actually use. This is a wild sorghum, an intermediate to a fairly compact, robust, high-yielding hybrid. We have things with crooked necks, right, developed in India and Ethiopia. The crooked necks allow for water to easily roll off this open panicle. This also has high lysine in it, this particular Dura does. Again, the converted material. We have different colors of sorghum. We have forage sorghums, which are a very unique type of sorghums. We have broom corn sorghums. I put this in here because broom corns were actually the first recorded record that we have of sorghum in the United States from 1757 in a letter from Benjamin Franklin. So Ben Franklin actually recognized the fact that you could make very good hat brooms out of sorghum. So because of its unique environmental conditions and its unique domestication, it's really allowed us to exploit a tremendous amount of variability and adaptability throughout the United States. So some of the things that we've benefited from what we now currently have over 40,000 accessions in the U.S. sorghum PI collection, we've been able to increase yield, stock strength, green bug, midge. We are exploiting a thing called cold tolerance. We'd like to be able to get it in the ground earlier, get it out of the ground earlier in colder temperatures and exploit some of our long season growing sorghums. Downy mildew resistance, anthracnose, and just recently been making a true huge improvements on our nutritional quality for the crop too. So again, because of sorghum's unique domestication, we've really been able to exploit this germplasm. And I think we in the U.S. and worldwide have really made tremendous advances because of that. The next step for us is really trying to exploit this genetic diversity at the genomic level. We've recently been sequenced. We were the second major cereal crop to be sequenced after rice. But to me, this is a little bit of a challenging endeavor. You take 40,000 accessions times about roughly 30,000 genes times 5 to 10 alleles per gene, and boy, we've got a lot of work to do. This is going to keep people busy for a long, long time, being able to really understand the genes that we have in our collection, how we're going to exploit them and utilize them in the future. One of the things that was probably the weakest part of our germplasm collection was our mutation library, which we essentially didn't have. Keith Schertz, who probably many of you knew, passed away several years ago and had been maintaining a rather small gene stocks for us. But currently the ARS has put together a very, very robust mutation library based on ATX-623, which was sequenced. And I think this will really go a long way of helping us identify genes and really isolating them, developing very robust markers so that we can actually use those genes in our germplasm collections to make even further progress. In fact, we're looking at thinking about sorghum in a little bit different ways in terms of trying to develop a genomics to breeding platform where we're able to take those 40,000 accessions and through diversity profiles really identify key genes that we can then rapidly move into improved lines. I mean, I think everybody has seen graphs like this. You know, everybody's making a lot of headway in these particular areas. I just hope we get there sooner rather than later. But overall, I think this genetic diversity has really allowed us to become one of the truly most adaptable crops worldwide. If you look at where sorghum can be grown, and I put sweet sorghum up here because I do a lot of bioenergy talks, and people ask me about sweet sorghum. But essentially, we can grow sorghum on about 80% of all the arable land in the world. Partly due to the fact that we have this tremendous genetic diversity within the crop that allows us to really be adapted to a wide range of different environments, climates, good climates, bad climates, poor rainfall, good rainfall. It really truly is a crop that should be more greatly exploited than it is. And finally, I want to leave you with this graph to think about a little bit. These are corn and sorghum national yields for the last 10 years, and we invariably always get compared to corn. Our producers always ask, how come we aren't making the progress that the corn guys are? Why aren't we making those huge yield increases? Well, over the last 10 years, I mean, if you really break this down, in fact, we're making a actually fairly good, almost close to 1.9 bushels an acre a year annual increase. Corn's up there about 2.65, and these are based on USDA numbers. We could argue these numbers until we're blue in the face. But I would argue that if you look at the past 10 years, corn's been making progress at about a $500 million to $1 billion a year per bushel increase, whereas sorghum is maybe anywhere from $25 million to $50 million for a bushel increase. So I would argue that for a cost of return, we're a much better crop than a lot of other crops out there in terms of how much money is being spent to increase that bushel year. But the reason we are able to do that is because in 1967, we recognized the importance of really bringing in exotic germplasm into the country and really trying to exploit the yield potential and the diversity within the crop. And so with that, I'm a little quick, but...
Very good. Thank you, Jeff.
I'm just going to do questions at the end.
Actually, we do have time. We've got time for questions. Any questions? Yes, sir. Repeat the question.
Talk about the color of sorghum. I was a germplasm collector in 1979 in Somalia, where an American variety descent came from Georgia, but it was white and quite non-compact, quite loose. And they preferred the compact oval shape, like a cricket mouse type of head.
One of the difficulties that we've had here in the United States of introducing sorghum as a food product for people is that when most people hear sorghum, they think of animal feed only. And so, we're a gluten-free flour. In fact, we're working our way into the gluten-free market. But we have had to spend some time of actually introducing people to the fact that sorghum is not a bad crop nutritionally. We've spent a considerable amount of time actually convincing people that sorghum isn't as bad as what they think it is. This is just part of dealing with perceptions about the crop and trying to get around and resolve some of those issues.
Other questions?
Seems like there's a big place for sorghum. A lot of places, like where I live, there's no place that takes it. Elevators, things like in the Mid-South. Mm-hmm. There's not as many breeders working on sorghum as corn. Mm-hmm. So it's remarkable to me that sorghum is making this much gain compared to corn.
Well, again, I think it's because we've been able to really exploit our germplasm. Oh, yeah, he was just commenting that where he's living, they're having difficulty actually getting elevators to accept sorghum and move sorghum around the country and actually to get anybody to really buy sorghum. And that's a problem that we've been running into recently, partly because it's just been dominated by corn, right? But I think one of the reasons, if you count the number of sorghum people working in the United States, you could probably cut this room in half, maybe into a quarter, and you'd have most of the sorghum people working on the crop. Again, I think the reason we've been able to make these kind of genetic gains is because of the diversity in the crop. And those people that are really dedicated to the crop, really understanding the genetic diversity and making a go out of it. How do we change elevators buying sorghum? That's a good question. That's something that one of the reasons you see that decline in the acres being planted in the U.S.
Not the question we are genetic gain is being made, but that's not genetic gain.
Well, right. I wish it was agronomy, because if it was agronomy, we'd be maybe.
Corn is fairly standard.
Right, but for us, we keep on being pushed to more marginal and marginal and marginal lands. We don't put fertilizer on our crop. We don't put insecticides on our crop. We rarely put herbicides on our crop. Ours, I think, is really more true genetic gain, because if we were actually doing the agronomy, that graph would be much higher. I understand that this is really not a reflection of genetic gain. I'm just trying to make a point.
Oh, no, your point was okay. Yeah. Improvements to be made, but those curves are not even genetic gain alone.
Right. For us, a lot of it.